the statesman.
Yeah.
Okay.
Our desires, our anger, all of these become gods. And each of these want to take us towards itself. Right?
Okay.
So we have many gods or just one god. Which one is better? And of course, just having one god, one set of rules, gives you more freedom than having many gods that contradict each other, right?
Yes.
So this is the fundamental basis of freedom when we talk about freedom in the context of Tawheed.
That's right.
Right? And this is why fundamentally you will never be able to get freedom in any other context. Other than Tawheed. This is why they're struggling in the West to define the best way to get to freedom. And they will never succeed.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Sadiq. And Brother Ali, thank you very much for your presence in the program. Viewpoint, it was very kind of you, the concept of freedom and liberty as discussed by the leader of the Islamic Ummah, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. It was very kind of you. And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening to us. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, you can visit our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Australia, the United Kingdom, and United States have formed a new military alliance called AUKUS. As part of this alliance, Australia will receive new missiles and a fleet of nuclear submarines built by the US and UK. Meanwhile, the United States will increase its military presence and operational capability in the region. This pact has angered France, who lost out on a contract to originally build diesel submarines for Australia. It's also been condemned by China, which views this increased militarization and buildup of foreign troops in its region as a threat. So what exactly is AUKUS? Is it really about promoting regional peace and stability in the Indo-Pacific, or part of a larger power struggle seeking to provoke China and project Western influence? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On September 15th, the Prime Ministers of Australia and the United Kingdom, Scott Morrison and Boris Johnson, along with the President of the United States, Joe Biden, issued a joint statement announcing a new military partnership between their three countries, called AUKUS. As part of this trilateral agreement, Australia would receive a fleet of nuclear-powered submarines. These would be built at Adelaide in South Australia with the help of the UK and the US. Australia confirmed that it would also be acquiring Tomahawk cruise missiles and joint air-to-surface standoff missiles from the US. In exchange, the United States will expand its already giant military footprint in Australia. The United States and Australia already have very close ties, being two of the Five Eyes members, along with the UK, Canada, and New Zealand. The US already has several military bases and around 2,500 Marines on permanent rotation in Australia. In addition to its own bases, the Asia-Pacific Journal writes that, quote, the US military has access to all major Australian Defence Forces training areas, Northern Australian Royal Air Force airfields, port facilities in Darwin and Fremantle. With AUKUS, those numbers would increase, as would the types of ordinances, as Peter Dutton, the Australian Defence Minister, confirmed. During a press conference, he went on to say that Australia and the United States will be significantly enhancing our force posture cooperation, increasing interoperability, and deepening alliance activities in the Indo-Pacific. This will include greater air cooperation through rotational deployments of all types of U.S. military aircraft to Australia. Now, while this agreement has been marketed as a defense pact, there are many who feel that Australia is giving much more than it's receiving, conceding much of its territorial, political, and military sovereignty to the United States. And nothing could be more emblematic of Australia's subservience to the United States than Joe Biden forgetting the Australian Prime Minister's name, Scott Morrison, during the unveiling of AUKUS.
Thank you, Boris, and I want to thank that fellow down under. Thank you very much, pal.
Besides not being able to say the name of the Australian Prime Minister, neither Biden nor Johnson and Morrison actually mentioned China by name. If you go and watch their full speeches, you'll only hear them say the Indo-Pacific.
The Indo-Pacific.
The Indo-Pacific.
We all recognize the imperative of ensuring peace and stability in the Indo-Pacific over the long term.
It's no secret that this entire thing is aimed at China. This is China's region, after all, and the West has been fear-mongering about them for years. Reacting to AUKUS, the spokesperson for the Chinese Foreign Ministry, Li Jianzhao, said that, quote, this severely undermines regional peace stability, intensifies arms race, and undercuts international non-proliferation efforts. It's highly irresponsible and shows double standards on using nuclear export for geopolitical games. So why China? What has China done that is so bad that these three countries are trying to gang up against it? Well, I think this clip from CNN might have some of the answers.
The trade routes that we use on the open seas need to be protected in the U.S., Australian, and U.K. view. They need to be protected by our collective forces in order to make sure that no other navy can interfere with the trade routes as they exist right now. So that means any oil, for example, that comes from the Middle East, any raw materials that come from Africa, things that China depends on a great deal.
But have they been doing that? Have the Chinese been stopping those trade routes?
Not yet. But the fear is that they could.
Well, there you go. You heard it straight from the horse's mouth. The colonel here is plainly saying China hasn't done anything. And more importantly, he's telling you the real reason behind all this. It's all about economic interests. It's about controlling shipping lanes, trade routes, oil and other natural resources near China. Which again, remember, China is the world's largest manufacturing country. And when they talk about countering China, this phrase, they use it all the time, but what does it mean? Why does China need to be countered? America has tons of military bases already surrounding China, not the other way around. And what is the United Kingdom doing on the other side of the planet? Do you know that China is Australia's largest trading partner? Why should Australia sour relations with them at the behest of the US? What, to satisfy America's foreign policy goals? Perhaps this is more to do with the West feeling nervous that China has a stronger, faster-growing economic model. China is on track to overtake the US and become the world's largest economy. China has the Belt and Road Initiative, a modern revival of Silk Road trade route. It just recently integrated Iran into it, among many other countries. China doesn't go around bombing other places to steal their resources. China has lifted millions of its own citizens out of poverty. It has a different mindset, a different social and economic system from the US. And Australia seems to be losing its sovereignty and essentially becoming a giant airbase for the Americans. Australia says it's non-nuclear, but will the United States respect that? Who's to say they won't keep nuclear missiles on Australian soil in secret? Does the US view Australia as expendable, perhaps just as a vassal state that it can exploit for its imperialist ambitions in a potential confrontation with China? To find out more, I thought I'd ask Dr. Alan Patience. He's an honorary principal fellow in the School of Social and Political Sciences at the University of Melbourne. He's taught political and Asian studies at universities in Australia and Japan. and has occupied visiting professorships in China, Taiwan, Burma, and Papua New Guinea. His work focuses on Australian foreign policy. Dr. Alan Patience, thanks so much for joining me today. It's great to have you on.
My pleasure.
Professor, you recently wrote that Australia is repeating certain foreign policy and defense mistakes from the last century. I was hoping if you can maybe elaborate on those mistakes for us.
Okay. Well, I was referring in that case to the 1919 peace conference in Paris after World War I. The Australian representative was our Prime Minister at the time, Mr. Billy Hughes, who was one of the leading architects of what was called the White Australia policy. He was an out-and-out racist and particularly disliked Asian people. The Japanese, of course, were represented at the peace conference in a quite significant delegation. They made some proposals that upset the Australian Prime Minister. The first proposal was that all German territories in the Pacific should be encouraged and helped by Australia and Japan together towards independence, to end colonialism, German colonialism. And the second proposal the Japanese made was that the new charter for the League of Nations that was being formed at much the same time should have an anti-racist clause in its charter. Now, Billy Hughes was absolutely horrified at these two suggestions. He opposed them bitterly. He was extremely rude in the conference proceedings. He used to put his foot up on the table and shout and just gesticulate, particularly at the Japanese, telling them off. And as a result, the Japanese, first of all, were humiliated at that conference. Eventually, they withdrew from the League of Nations. And certainly, that was a contribution to the enmity that was created between Japan and Australia in World War II in the Pacific theater. And what I was trying to suggest is that Scott Morrison, our present Prime Minister, is doing exactly the same thing. He's now being very rude about China in a number of international forums and provoking China's hostility. So I think history is repeating itself.
When it comes to Australia and what Australia has to gain from all this, these nuclear submarines, it's said they won't be arriving anytime soon. As a matter of fact, we've heard the year 2040 being floated around. So if Australia has to wait two decades for these submarines, what exactly are America and the UK gaining in the meantime from this partnership with Australia, especially in terms of being able to use Australian territory and soil?
First of all, I think it's important to note that there is no submarine at the moment. All there is a promise that nuclear power will be made available for whatever submarine is chosen in a time frame of the next 18 months. So it's still a fantasy. It's not a reality at all. But what will the Americans achieve? Well, for a long time now, Australia's military capacity, defence capacity, has been, and I've got to use an awful official word here, interoperable with the United States military. That is to say, we are really just a very small part of the US military and defense arrangements in the Asia-Pacific region. This now consolidates that relationship as far as the Americans are concerned. There's been some talk emerging in Australia, particularly during the time of Trump's presidency, that maybe we can't rely on America any longer. And that's a feeling that's been growing. And the Americans want to counter this. And they've come in now with this proposal. And at the same time, and by the way, the concerns about America's reliability, we had one former prime minister, for example, saying that it's time to rip up the alliance with the United States. And that would mean, amongst other things, kicking Pine Gap, which is a huge American spy base in the middle of Australia that's been spying on China and other East and Southeast Asian countries, getting rid of that, for example, and that would really remove a major part of the US's intelligence capacity, gathering capacity in this region. So America is in pushing us into this arrangement, if you like, is consolidating its grip on Australia's sovereignty very strongly. As far as the British are concerned, I think it's just empire nostalgia. They still think of Australia as a colony, and in many respects we still are a colonial mindset. And yes, it's, for the British, They might get one of their submarines selected, but it's very unlikely. I'm sure it'll be an American submarine.
You mentioned Australian sovereignty. What does AUKUS entail exactly for Australia's sovereignty? How does it get out of this colonial mindset?
I think it's important to note that in international politics, international relations, Australia styles itself as a middle power, a so-called middle power. I've argued elsewhere that there are different kinds of middle powers, but the kind of middle power that Australia is as a dependent middle power. Its claims to have a kind of middle power status are entirely reliant on its alliances with big powers, and in this case, the United States. So already, as a dependent middle power, Australia's sovereignty has been severely constrained. As the former Prime Minister that I was referring to earlier, Malcolm Fraser, he was a Conservative Prime Minister, by the way, who's saying, let's get rid of the American alliance. And he was saying, look, Australia has very little sovereignty. And AUKUS, as they call this new strange arrangement, is yet further evidence that we are very lacking in sovereignty, that we will do, we'll always do as we're told. And that's evident, for example, in that Australia has been into every single war that the United States has had since the end of World War II, well, during World War II as well. We've been into every single war, the Korea Peninsula War, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, and so on. It's quite extraordinary. In many respects, we're a very warmongering country, but very keen to be with America in its wars.
Dr. Alan Patience, thank you so much for your time, Professor. Really a pleasure speaking with you and having you on.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
AUKUS has caused a real diplomatic row with the French. France is actually very upset with all this, not because Western imperialists are antagonizing China, but because they didn't get the contracts and the money to help do it. France had a deal worth 90 billion Australian dollars to build diesel power submarines for Australia. Without informing the French, Scott Morrison just went and ripped up the contract and entered Australia into this new alliance instead with the US and the UK. I guess he figured that American nuclear-powered submarines would be much better. And France, of course, considers this to be a real stab in the back and is so angry it pulled out of a planned ceremony with the U.S. commemorating the 240th anniversary of the Battle of Cape. French President Emmanuel Macron said that it's important for Europe to stop being naive and assert its independence from the United States. The French are so outraged that the defense minister pulled out of talks with the U.K., and in an unprecedented move, France even recalled its ambassadors to Australia and the U.S. To gain further insight into this diplomatic row, joining me is Bruce Haig, an Australian political commentator, author, and former diplomat. He served in several countries, first in South Africa, where he made friends with anti-apartheid activists and even helped some of them escape the country. He also served in Afghanistan, Iran, Indonesia, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Sri Lanka. Bruce, it's great to have you on. Welcome to the communique.
Thank you. Pleasure.
So, Bruce, when we speak about the relationship that Australia has with France, how does AUKUS and the diplomatic fallout that's resulted from it impact the relationship?
Richard, that's a good question because the French are quite influential, as you know, in Europe. Britain's out of it, much to everybody's delight, I would hope, and think. But in its present form, I mean, Britain is still hasn't had the social revolution that it needs. It's still a hugely unequal society and racist to boot. But so France has got a considerable influence in Europe, and it will bring that influence to bear Merkel's about to go. We don't know who will replace her, but whoever replaces her will not have the experience that Merkel had. So Macron is now a senior statesperson in Europe, and he's really angry. So I can't imagine that the trade deal that was in being drawn up will happen. It'll be pushed to one side, and it won't be revised, I don't think, until Morrison's government has been voted out of office in Australia.
So we know that they didn't tell the French about their plans to rip up this deal. Could you maybe tell us about who else was left in the dark in terms of the Australian government, the Australian Defence Forces? Because there were also other people in Australia who didn't know about this. Is that correct?
Yes, that's certainly it seems that way. It would seem that this is a deal that's been done between people in the United States or people around Biden and Morrison and some of his staff members. But it seems, and maybe it includes Dutton, who's the Minister for Defence, but it seems it didn't include the Department of Defence because they wrote a letter to the French, which the French received on the same day that the Australians broke the contract. So, to me, officials within our Department of Defence were not in the loop. They don't know the cost. I mean, when you're spending 85 to 100 billion of taxpayers' money on an item like as large as this, you would normally go out to contract and say, look, and you'd, the lead-in time with the French would be over a period of 6 months or a year of saying, look, we're going to have to break this contract and discuss the terms of breaking the contract and all those sorts of things so that you didn't upset the French. So the submarine deal, they're saying we wouldn't get the submarines until 2040 at the earliest and maybe 2050, which to me means that the submarine deal isn't a real deal at all. It's a smokescreen in order to get the United States into Australia and get their nuclear submarines based in Fremantle, at the Garden Island and in the Northern Territory, perhaps build another port, get their stealth bombers and B-52s permanently based in Tyndall Air Force Base in the north, and maybe build some other bases in Northern Australia.
So what are the motivations behind AUKUS? Why this pact at this point in time with these three countries?
The Americans are getting increasingly worried about, they've got themselves into a mindset, they're paranoid, they're feeding off their own hysteria about China. So they've got themselves into a mindset that they need to act very, very quickly. And so they came up with this idea of gazumping the French and their submarine deal, pushing the French out of, or marginalising the French in the Pacific, giving the primary role to the US. Johnson's just a hanger-on in all of this. He's trying to get some British glory day back after the mess up of Brexit, and it's a complete mess. So Johnson's a hanger-on, and America is now happy enough to have Johnson hanging on, but wants Australia as a base for its naval assets and for army. I don't know what they're going to use the army for, to occupy the islands in the South China Sea. But, I mean, they just want a presence in Australia, an increased military presence. And that increased military presence will give them control over the Australian, a greater control over the Australian political process. So AUKUS is really about the Americans wanting to use Australia, as they did in the Second World War, as a kind of a large aircraft carrier. And give some legitimacy to what they're on about, which is confronting China because of their fear of China's rivalry.
So when we talk about trade, Australia's largest trading partner is China. How does this whole situation affect the relationship with the Chinese? This has always seemed odd to me. You know, Australia needs China, and yet we have this behavior from the United States pushing Australia into confrontation. So how does this affect the relationship with China? What's the Chinese response been? And what's the response been from the other countries and territories in the Indo-Pacific to this pact?
Well, in Southeast Asia, other countries are not at all happy. They haven't expressed themselves forcefully in public, But behind the scenes, they're very angry and concerned. China, of course, is they won't deal with Morrison, and they won't deal with his government. Morrison doesn't have any life experience. He is unable to process these sorts of relationships. He hasn't got a clue. China is now being referred to by within circles in Australia, by certainly by the Americans, but we've picked up they're the enemy. So, you know, we're referring to our major trading partner as the enemy. I don't even begin to understand the logic of that. From Australia's point of view, China's not going anywhere, and neither are we. As much as we'd like to sit offshore from America, it's not going to happen. We're firmly grounded here at the bottom of Asia, and that's our future and that's our destiny. And China is China, and it's going to be there, and it's going to continue to influence the states around it in the Pacific and in the region. Countries are going to pick up with Belt and Road, and they're going to want the infrastructure that China's providing and promising.
Bruce Haig, thank you so much for your time. Such a pleasure speaking with you. Despite the claim that AUKUS will boost peace and stability in the region, it already seems to be achieving the opposite. China will perceive a heightened presence of a foreign military as a threat, just like any country would, and naturally want to defend itself. Having more British, American, and Australian forces trying to provoke China is only going to escalate things and maybe lead to an arms race or, worse, a military confrontation. The Americans said they would bring peace and stability to the Middle East. Look how that turned out. You know, America and Britain, they just go park fleets of warships, they fly nuclear bombers on Iran's doorstep, or in this case, China's doorstep, and then talk about countering China as if China is the one camped out in the Florida Keys. This is absurd. Just imagine the reaction if China put its warships in the English Channel or off the coast of California. They would lose it. Just look at the response when the Soviet Union put missiles in Cuba in 1962. They're still talking about it to this day. You know, last time I checked, China isn't the one who just pulled out of Afghanistan after occupying it for 20 years. China didn't commit war crimes in Iraq and Libya. China doesn't have 800 military bases around the world. China offers a different economic model, an alternative way of doing things that doesn't involve aggression and imperialism. China's way of doing things is based on agreement and cooperation, and is soon to become the world's largest economic power. Australia has always clung to Uncle Sam's coattails and needs the United States to feel that it can project a certain degree of power. Now, the United Kingdom longs for the old days of its empire. It just wants to appear relevant after Brexit. That's why they formed AUKUS. As for America, after Afghanistan, America needs a new enemy to justify its $740 billion military budget and to keep expanding its empire and ensure corporate profits. And this is the crux of the issue. Capitalists, imperialists, they hate competition. They want to monopolize. They want to assert dominance and control over every market, every situation. And in the great power struggle between the West and China, the West is scared. Not because China actually poses a threat, but because China proposes an alternate way of doing things and is able to rival them through a different model, making theirs look outdated, weak, and obsolete. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند ذکر خداست، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Dear brothers and sisters, you are listening to The Spring of Truth from IRIB English Radio. I invite you to listen to a short part of the book Sirr al-Salat, The Secret of Prayer, written by Imam Khomeini. The Qiyam and the recitation is the agent Tawheed Iyyaka na'budu is the returning of the servant to Allah toward the absolute annihilation. Because for each recitation and prostration and genuflection, there is a stage. Thus, Qiyam to the stage of agent Tawheed has been related, though it possesses the essential Tawheed and the attribute internally. And this the same words as the mystic utter about the names, attributes, verbs, and essence, though they consider each name as a collective comprehensive name in which the manifestation of the name is appeared. And the manifestation of the attribute and essential would be therein. And the same in namely attribute and the essential one.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And you are listening to Spring of Truth coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So stay tuned with us. I am your host, Abdullah Al-Musawi, an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qom. We are looking at Imam Khomeini's point of view when it comes to Ashura. Imam Khomeini was quoted saying, "If people could truly understand and make it understood by others what all this is about, the lamentation, the mournings, and the eulogies, and why such high divine reward for a drop of tear shed for Imam Hussein, they would not call us the weeping nation. Rather, they would call us the nation of epic action." Imam Hussein, he himself said, "I only made this revolution to seek reform." So through these cries, through these gatherings, through these mournings, we are trying to create reform. And we did. And first of which, Imam Khomeini, he himself, he created this massive revolution, toppled the government, changed an entire world. Not just that, but the whole world is facing it. The whole world, they are just powerless to do anything against it. They are powerless to stop it. And why is that? Because they are crying for Imam al-Hussein. Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum. If it was just a matter of logic, you can just read a book and stay at home. You can just, I don't know, read the Quran and stay at home. But the idea is that we come every year. Not only should we listen to the lecture, not only should we just learn, but we need to lament and cry and beat our chest and have these things and make them continue and live. At the time of the Imams, alayhim as-salam, when they were living under oppressive rulers, they couldn't do much. They couldn't preach and lecture. But they instructed their followers to sit and cry for Imam Hussein. That's it, just cry. Read a eulogy, beat your chest, cry for Imam Hussein, and keep it going. Keep that emotion flowing. Throughout this lamentation and this flowing of emotions, we got to have all these that we have today. All these lecturers, all these scholars standing on the pulpits. It's because of this crying. So don't just listen and go. Participate. Take a share in making sure that this continues to generations to come.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
About you, IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The frightening point is that all the evidence suggests that the U.S. was able to manipulate the legal processes in both Sweden and the U.K. to engineer effective incarceration all that time and to this day, says Jonathan Cook, writer, in an article titled CIA Plan to Poison Assange Wasn't Needed. U.S. Found Lawful Way to Disappear Him. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. Yahoo News investigation reveals that through much of 2017, the CIA weighed up whether to use wholly extrajudicial means to deal with the supposed threat posed by Julian Assange and his whistleblower's platform, WikiLeaks. The agency plotted either to kidnap or assassinate him. Shocking as the revelations are, exposing the entirely lawless approach of the main U.S. intelligence agency, the Yahoo investigation nonetheless tends to obscure rather than shine a light on the bigger picture. Assange has not been deprived of his freedom for more than a decade because of an unimplemented rogue operation by the CIA. Rather, he has been held in various forms of captivity, disappeared through the collaborations of various national governments and their intelligence agencies, aided by legal systems and the media that have systematically violated his rights and legal due process. The reality of Assange's years of prosecution is far worse even than the picture of a thuggish, vengeful, power-mad CIA painted by Yahoo reporting. More than 30 former senior officials who either served in the U.S. Foreign Intelligence Agency or the Trump administration helped to piece together for Yahoo the various components of the CIA's plan. They show that the agency considered two main options for dealing with Assange in addition to then-secret moves by laying the groundwork for prosecuting the WikiLeaks founder in the U.S. courts. One plan was to kidnap Assange from Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he had been seeking political asylum since 2012. The aim was to smuggle him to the U.S., violating the sovereignty of the Ecuador and the U.K. in an operation that would have had all the hallmarks of extraordinary rendition. That was the illegal procedure the U.S. used after 9/11 to abduct suspects in the so-called War on Terror. Usually so, they could be sent to black sites, where they were tortured and held without judicial oversight. The other CIA proposal was to assassinate Assange, or perhaps more accurately, commit extrajudicial murder to silence him once and for all. Poisoning him was reportedly one of the methods considered. These scenarios need to be borne in mind when we cast our minds back to 2012, to the moment Assange decided to seek sanctuary in Ecuador's embassy, fearing the wrath of the U.S. at his exposure of his crimes in Afghanistan and Iraq. Not a single corporate journalist gave credence to his concerns. In fact, they ridiculed them. These latest revelations confirm what was obvious to many of the rest of us. Assange had very good reasons indeed to seek political asylum. Let us examine that bigger picture obscured by the reporting of the CIA's plan. The agency's much greater interest in Assange's case and its more openly hostile attitude towards him were a result of WikiLeaks' release of parts of a cache of secret files on the CIA's hacking capabilities known as Vault 7. The agency, considering it the largest data loss in CIA history, was deeply humiliated by the exposure. The misleading impression created by the Yahoo investigation is that until 2017, a standard legal process was being pursued against Assange that only turned rogue after the Vault 7 release, when the CIA wanted vengeance and to intimidate WikiLeaks to prevent any further leaks. In the words of one Trump national security official, there was an inappropriate level of attention to Assange given the CIA's embarrassment, not the threat he posed in the context. We should never act out of a desire for revenge, unquote. The implication is that because the CIA's various extrajudicial plots were never implemented, justice has otherwise been well served in Assange's case. But the CIA plans indicate something else entirely. They show that once the CIA was an infuriated by WikiLeaks' exposure of the agency's own crimes as the Pentagon, the State Department and the White House already were up theirs. It joined them in getting more actively involved in an existing extrajudicial process meant to finish off Assange and WikiLeaks. From the moment Assange's legal troubles began in late 2010, when two Swedish women were reported to have launched allegations of rape, nothing followed the standard procedure. Swedish police, the country's media, and a second prosecutor all meddled in a case the main prosecutor had already ruled did not involve a criminal offense. The testimony of one of the women, who had been encouraged to go to the police by the other, was effectively hijacked and turned into a rape allegation, seemingly against her wishes. Inexplicably, Interpol issued a red notice for Assange's arrest, usually reserved for terrorists and dangerous criminals, shortly after Swedish officials had approved his traveling abroad. In the UK, the courts approved an extradition warrant for Assange that had been issued without any Swedish judicial authority. The ruling set such a terrible legal precedent that the agreement on which the extradition was based was amended shortly afterwards to ensure such a ruling could not be made again. Once Assange fled to Ecuador's embassy, the UK government surrounded it with huge numbers of police at great public expense. For a while, government ministers threatened to tear up diplomatic protocols established in by law, sending police in to arrest Assange on foreign soil. A Freedom of Information request shows Britain's prosecution service pressured Swedish prosecutors not to come to London to interview Assange through 2010 and 2011, thereby creating the embassy standoff that began a short time later. Other evidence shows Swedish prosecutors were regularly interviewing the suspects in the UK. Only in Assange's case was that made impossible. British prosecutors destroyed emails relating to Assange to circumvent another FOI request, but the few that survive by mistake show it meddling directly in a case it should have had no legal stake in. In one, a Swedish proposed dropping the investigation against Assange in 2013, UK officials warned, "Don't you dare." Another Evilink email stated, "Please do not think this case is being dealt with as just another extradition." This and much more took place before the CIA plans exposed by Yahoo were being hashed in 2017. 2 years later, Assange was dragged by London police from the Ecuador embassy in a scenario that echoed the CIA's plan. Since then, new, even more irregular legal proceedings, either for a supposed minor bail violation or for espionage in exposing U.S. war crimes, have kept Assange indefinitely locked up in a London maximum security prison. The point here is that the idea that the CIA suddenly tried to interfere in a sound legal process against Assange is laughable. Everything about the Assange case from the outset had been extrajudicial in the sense that there has been no legal basis for proceedings. It has been legal theater. Concealing the brute force of an unaccountable superpower, angry and fearful that in the digital age, its secrets and crimes can no longer be concealed from the public. What the CIA brought to the table was not some new interest in extrajudicial vengeance. That was at the core of Assange's treatment from the outset. But the specific extrajudicial tools it excels in, such as abduction and murder.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, take counsel to be guided. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Group work always produces synergistic benefits, improvement and development. When many heads come together, their collective experience and knowledge can be tapped to facilitate planning, problem solving, productivity, creativity, and innovation. Those who have become self-opinionated and obstinate often suffer from mistakes and losses. Everyone has unique mental powers. We all know that. Allah has blessed us all with different skill sets, different level of intellect. One mind may produce a brain wave that would never occur to another. When the bright ideas of many minds combine, they would produce a light that can illuminate many and any darkness. Let us all decide to adopt the practice of always consulting with informed and intelligent persons. Imam Hassan, the second infallible Imam, has said, "Nations in which consultation with each other is practiced are always guided to their welfare and benefit." if we look around and if we see the blessings and the barakat of those who are taking counsel, those who are involving other people in group works, taking help from others, utilizing other people's strengths, when it comes to them producing results, it's much, much better and more effective than those who work in isolation. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are talking about the importance of taking counsel to be guided. You know, sometimes we become so self-opinionated and so self-centric that we think that everything that we are planning and thinking suffices and is sufficient and is the best that can be done. Well, guess what? This is not how this world is designed. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blessed us all with different abilities and capabilities. The design is that we all come together to work towards a common goal, a bigger goal. This allows us not only to plan better, not only to be more productive and creative and innovative. In addition to this, it assists and helps us in terms of the distribution of work. The workload for any project, for any task, for any sublime goal is bigger than what we expect it to be. And this is typically what happens when we walk into any field, a field of study it be, or a field of research. We realize that there is so much depth. We need more helping hands. And you see that those who manage to bring other people on board and are ready to work with other people, they end up producing effective results. Otherwise, you know, there's so many things that stay on our wish list, and then the life, it comes to an end. So if we want to deliver something before we leave this world, something in the field of academia or otherwise, we need to be able to, and we need to learn to be able to work with others, use their capabilities, and let our capabilities and abilities be used by others, again, for those righteous goals. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.